There's a prayer that is traditionally prayed often in liturgical services that I love, that from the Psalms. So would you pray with me before this message? Oh God, may the meditation, the words of my mouth, and the meditation of our hearts be pleasing in your sight, oh God, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. When I was 13, my mom had a charm class in our house. We invited my friends from school, and we all sat around my kitchen table. And a woman, I don't remember her name, but I can remember vividly what she looked like. She was tall, and she was very elegantly dressed, and she had on lots of makeup, and she wore very high heels. And I can just see her at the head of the table, just standing so appropriately, and telling us how to cut our meat, and what fork to use, and how to eat, and you know, what is appropriate at the table. And then later on, I think we did a little makeup lesson, and you know, we're taught how to put age-appropriate makeup on, and we were taught to cross our ankles and not our knee or legs, and it was all about being appropriate. And in college, I went out on a date one time, and this young man told me that I was the most polite eater that he had ever been out with. So it worked. It worked until I went to Europe, moved to Europe, where there are completely different ways of eating. I mean, there you hold a fork and a knife, and I realized that that was actually a lot easier than keeping trading hands and putting one down and trying to keep my hand up on the right the table at the right time and one hand down. And so I kind of got messed up there. And then there's having kids, where you're just shoving food in as fast as you can while it's still hot before they cry again. So I'm not sure that all of the manners are still present. I try to be appropriate when I'm out, but my daughters are like, "Mom, your elbow's on the table," you know. So, charm class. Back to manners. One of my favorite movie or TV shows right now, probably my very favorite TV show, is Downton Abbey. Any Downton Abbey fans out there? It's on Masterpiece Theater, and it's all about this land-owning gentry family in the turn of the 20th century. And it just arrives into their life and into their servants' lives, and you get a sense of how this whole house works together. And you get a sense of the separation that occurred between the servants and the gentry, and how things were beginning to be mixed as the Roaring Twenties came and pretensions began to wear down and things began to change. But there is a book that was published in 1908 on manners in Britain about the same time as Downton Abbey, and I wanted to read a few of those to you. It says, "You should never ask any person at a table to help you do anything. Always apply to the servants. Servants should wait at the table wearing clean white gloves. There are few things more disagreeable than the thumb of a clumsy waiter on your plate. At dinner, where common household bread is used, it should never be cut less than an inch and a half thick. There is nothing more plebeian than thin bread. It may never cross the minds of some people to thank a servant. Others say it out of graciousness of mind and manner. Offering an occasional thanks to the parlor maid or manservant would not go amiss, but it must be said in a manner that will not encourage familiarity." And this is my favorite one. "There is no worthier accomplishment for a man with a mustache than to take soup in an inoffensive manner. And by no means should the mustache be used to strain the soup." So in our text today, we find Jesus at a meal. And there were different social conventions in his time than there was in early 20th century England, but there were still a lot of social conventions. You who you ate with said a lot about your social status. What you ate said a lot about your religious piety. You wanted to keep things clean. You only invited people who were of equal social rank, people that could reciprocate in kind to you. And it was kind of a whole social drama around eating that Jesus was participating in. And in the book of Luke, it's said by one commentator that in the Gospel of Luke, Jesus is either going to a meal, at a meal, or leaving a meal, which I think is why the Gospel of Luke is my very favorite gospel. Because I like to eat and I like to enjoy time with friends around a table. But it's at this gathering, and it's on the Sabbath, and the beginning of Luke 14 starts with Jesus healing a man right there on the Sabbath, and basically saying, "Can you argue with me for healing someone?" And then he looks around the table and he notices how people have been set up and where they're sitting, and he says to the guests, "Don't choose the places of honor. Choose a lower place. If you're supposed to be honored, you'll be honored, but don't vie, don't try to gain honor by where you sit." And he says to the hosts at the table, "Don't just invite those people who can reciprocate to you. Invite the people, the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame, the people who cannot reciprocate. Invite them to your table." This advice, the table etiquette, by Jesus' standards, was completely blew their minds, completely blew open their social norms. It was a totally different way of thinking about how they related and what their social status would be, because doing those things would completely eliminate their social status in many ways. And it's so in this it's in this context and in these teachings that Jesus shares a parable with them. And we've been talking about the parables of Jesus for the last few weeks, and this is our last week, and this is our last parable. Starting in Luke 14, verse 16. Then Jesus said, "Someone gave a great dinner and invited many. At the time for the dinner, he sent his slave to say to those who had been invited, 'Come, for everything is ready now.' But they all alike began to make excuses. The first said to him, 'I have bought a piece of land, and I must go out and see it. Please accept my regrets.' Another said, 'I have bought 5 yoke of oxen, and I'm going to try them out. Please accept my regrets.' Another said, 'I have just been married, and therefore I cannot come.' So the slave returned and reported this to his master. And then the owner of the house became angry and said to the slave, 'Go out at once into the streets and lanes of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame.' And the slave said, 'Sir, what you ordered has been done, and there is still room.' Then the master said to the slave, 'Go out into the roads and lanes and compel people to come in so that my house may be filled. For I tell you, none of those who were invited will taste my dinner.'" Interesting story of a great banquet. Interesting moment where the invitation is sent out, and in that time it was customary for there to be 2 kind of levels of invitation. You got the first one telling you when the time and place was, and then when everything was ready, you would be summoned to come. But the excuses were pretty flimsy. I mean, who would buy a piece of land without looking at it? Well, there's lots of people in Bend that would do that. But because they come and they think, oh, it's in Bend, it can't be bad, right? So that's how half our real estate is sold, I think. But it's not common to buy a piece of land and have to then to go check it out and why at that very moment, why can't it wait a day? Or imagine buying 5 used cars, sight unseen and not test driving them, and then going to see how they are. This other gentleman had bought 5 oxen and hadn't tested them out. And as far as the marriage excuse, well, you know, I don't know. you know, a wife is there when you get home. A wife, you know, you've probably been planning for this party. Just having to go home to your wife might not necessarily be a great excuse. So we've got three pretty flimsy excuses coming back at this host of why his friends can't come to the dinner. Social conventions of the first century aside, this story makes me feel that moment of panic that I felt in middle school and high school. You know, like when you just hope that the right person is going to ask you to the dance, or you just hope that you'll get invited to the right party, or you have a party. I remember I had someone threw me a 16th birthday party, and I remember looking around hoping that people that I thought were cool had come to my birthday party. That kind of that internal adolescent desire to be in with the cool crowd, to make sure that our social status is set, to make sure we're seen and accepted by the right people. And then that moment when sometimes it just doesn't work and you feel like you're out there alone. You know that feeling? Do you remember that from adolescence? And sadly, it doesn't always leave in adolescence. For much of our life, we can often be concerned about where we're being invited, which party, who we're being seen with, who are our friends. For some people, their entire lives can be caught up in that same kind of drama. Sometimes as we grow up, it doesn't become as much about the parties and the social gatherings. It can become about being right or being wrong. Are you on the right side of things or the wrong side of things? And religious people are infamous for this. Richard Rohr says, we want a religion in which we can win. And so if someone else is losing, that must mean I'm winning, right? And so we pride ourselves on being on the right side of things, on being on the inside. Now there are lots of sermons to be preached from this passage. It could be a really good finger wagging about the necessity of inviting the poor and the blind and the crippled and the lame to our parties and into our lives. And so we should. Or there could be a sermon on being the guest and accepting the invitation. And we could talk about how distracted so many of us are by things like possessions and our relationships and these other things that we don't accept the invitation by God to the feast of grace, and we should put away those distractions and accept that invitation. And so we should. But what interested me in this passage this week as I sat with it was the moment for the host when a servant comes back and gives all those flimsy excuses. What happened for him in that moment when he realized his social status had been compromised, that he had been rejected, that all of the rules by which he had followed were not working for him? What happened in that moment for him? It says he was angry. He went out, sent his servant out, and I imagine that anger arose out of hurt and disappointment and shock. And what led him to, instead of letting the food go to waste but not risking a social status, what led him to invite others? Others who would completely destroy his social status into his home to share the meal with him. What made that switch? What happened in that moment for him? I'm curious about that. I think there's an invitation for all of us in that moment, in that turn, to think about our own conversion as well. Our own conversion away from defining ourselves by what other people think of us, defining ourselves by how we look, defining ourselves by our status, defining ourselves by who we eat with, and instead to discover that we are defined by love, that we are invited to a table, that those things don't matter as much. The mystics call this the difference between the false self and the true self. The false self is that person that we put out, that we learn to be in the world. It's, you know, we maybe our job, it's the people we talk to, it's the things we know, it's how witty we can be in conversation. It's whatever we look to give us meaning and to give us identity. It's that constantly looking over our shoulder to see who's looking and what people are thinking of us. That's the false self. The true self is that person inside of us who we truly are, created by God, defined by love, and able to freely love others. And in some ways, we're born in that true self, and then we go through life and we pick up all of these expectations, whether it be at charm school or in university or through friendships. We take on all of these things that we think we should be over time. And the invitation that comes to us, the invitation that God is continually giving to us, especially as we journey into adulthood, is to begin to let go of some of those things, to return to that true self, to let go of needing to be the cool kid on the block. It's a profound journey, and it's one that we're always on, I think. We never truly arrive. And when life interrupts us, when we maybe lose a marriage, when someone doesn't accept our invitation to a dinner, when the expectations that we had for our children don't quite pan out the way we wanted, when we get a diagnosis of cancer or some other disease, when we face tragedy, and also when beautiful things happen to us, when we're confronted by a beauty that we can't describe, or just encounter a love and a welcome from someone that goes beyond what we've ever known. Those moments, and someone described religion as disruption, which I love. Wouldn't that be nice if we saw religion as a place where we can be disrupted out of our false selves? It's in those moments where we can choose, like this gentleman in the story, what we're going to do with that. We can shut down, we can hold on to our false selves, and we can keep trying, or we can open ourselves up more to love. Life is a process of being invited more and more into our inner selves. I had such a moment just a few weeks ago when I was in South Dakota and visiting my family. And we went to the property where my grandmother, who I described in the beginning, grew up. Her house that she lived in and she grew up in is still there. And there are four generations of her family still living on the property and farming the land. And they embraced me and my family so deeply and gave us such a wonderful day and a half with them. And on the last morning before we left, I was in, they call it a mule. It's like a little tiny tractor trailer thing that they use to go all around the property and drop things off and carry things. So it's like a little tiny truck. And my great aunt and my second cousin were in the front. And I was sitting in the back by myself and flying through this hay field and looking out at this property and looking out at this acreage where my grandmother grew up. And just feeling so, in that moment, embraced by this family, feeling so connected to my grandmother, to my grandfather who just passed a month ago, feeling so free. And I thought, you know, I have spent a lot of years trying to develop an identity that is so far away from this place. I have a master's degree. I've, you know, gotten a whole different kind of education. I've lived in urban areas, which I love, and I have, you know, tried to be sophisticated in conversation and tried to develop this whole sense of urban identity the last few years to kind of get away from this down home place that I grew up in, not in South Dakota, but in California, but coming from the same place. And in that moment, it just all seemed so foolish. Not that I still wouldn't love to have a good meal in Berkeley. I'm not saying that, I'd say to my husband. But the false selfness of it, the trying to develop a whole identity that would deny this kind of welcome and this kind of hospitality from people who don't have master's degrees, who haven't gone very far outside of this small area, who, in God's name, don't even recycle. And yet... and yet they gave me such a welcome and made me feel so loved. And I felt so connected to where I came from, to these Germans that moved to Russia to farm and moved to the Dakotas and lived this hard life, that was still within me. And it was just a moment of letting go of some of those things and remembering who I am, where I came from, and how God's love has showed up in my life, and returning to that in that moment. So disruption. We can be disrupted by so many things, and it's our choice how we respond in that moment. It's our choice where we move from that point. We can choose to move deeper into our true self or to hold to the false self. And you've seen people that are holding to it. It's not very pretty, ever. It's important to invite the poor and the crippled and the blind and the lame to our dinners, because they need to eat. But we also realize that we are also hungry. We are also hungry for love. We are also hungry to know that love that lives in us. The Persian poet Hafiz said, "God is trying to sell you something, but you don't want to buy. This is what your suffering is, your fantastic haggling, your manic screaming over the price." The false self doesn't go down easy, but we're invited to this journey to become the love that lives within us and is our true self. Then when we do that, we don't have to remind ourselves to invite the poor, the blind, the crippled, and lame. We know that we are one of them, and so it just happens. Just like this man, it just becomes natural to welcome others into our world and to reach out and to accept love. My very favorite movie, and I know I say I have a lot of, like, I'm, you know, 10 million best friends and a lot of favorite, but I would say this is my very favorite movie. And I think it really is, because it keeps coming back to it. It's the movie About Schmidt. I don't know if you've seen it. Jack Nicholson, who I love when he's not being creepy, plays this character, Warren Schmidt. And Warren retires from the insurance business in the movie, and we see him at his retirement party. And he has played all of the right roles. He has, you know, done his duty to his family and to his society. And he and his wife are on their own, and they decide to buy a motorhome. And then then one day she's cleaning house, and she just falls dead from a blood clot. And so his life just continues to unravel as he processes his wife's death, and he goes in her closet and finds all these letters, love letters that she had written to one of his best friends like 30 years before. And he meets his daughter's fiance, who is a waterbed salesman. And who basically, if you have a stereotype of a waterbed salesman, the fiance is that. And so Warren goes on this journey. He gets in the motorhome, and he leaves over Omaha, Nebraska to go to Colorado. And he's driving his motorhome, and he's convinced that he's going to tell Jeannie that she can't marry the waterbed salesman and that this is all going to work. And he gets there, and turns out he's not successful. And you see him at the wedding, and he's just dejected. And what happens early on in the movie is that he has been watching TV, and he sees an ad to sponsor a child in Africa. And he decides to go ahead and do that. And so throughout the movie, he's writing letters to this six-year-old boy named Ndugu, who lives in Africa. And what is so touching and amusing about this, these letters, is that he assumes that the 6-year-old African boy knows exactly what it's like to be a 65-year-old man in Omaha, Nebraska. He tells him about his motorhome, he tells him about his daughter, he tells him about all these things. And after the wedding, we hear this letter that Warren is writing to Ndugu, his final letter in the movie. He says, "I know we're all pretty small in the big scheme of things, and I suppose the most you can hope for is to make some kind of difference. But what kind of difference have I made? What in the world is better because of me? I tried to convince Jeannie she was making a big mistake, but I failed. Now she's married to that nincompoop, and there's nothing I can do about it. I am weak, and I am a failure. There's just no getting around it. Relatively soon, I will die. Once I die and everyone who knew me dies too, it will be as if I never even existed. What difference has my life made to anyone? None that I can think of. Hope things are fine with you. Yours truly, Warren Schmidt." I love this because it's the moment where he really sees the false self for what it is. He really sees what he's left with. And I'd like to just play for you the final scene of the movie.
Warren Schmidt. My name is Sister Nadine Gauthier of the Order of the Sisters of the Sacred Heart. I work in a small village near the town of Mbeya in Tanzania. One of the children I care for is little Ndugu Umbo, the boy you sponsor. Ndugu is a very intelligent boy and very loving. He is an orphan. Recently, he needed medical attention for an infection of the eye, but he's better now. He loves to eat melon, and he loves to paint. And Ndugu and I want you to know that he receives all of your letters. He hopes that you are happy in your life and healthy. He thinks of you every day, and he wants very much your happiness. And Ndugu is only 6 years old and cannot read or write, but he has made for you a painting. He hopes that you will like his painting. Yours sincerely, Sister Nadine Gauthier.
Of the desert. God is gathering us out of all regions until he can make resurrection of our own hearts from the very earth and teach us that we are all of one substance and members of one another. For the one who loves his neighbor loves God, and the one who loves God loves his own soul. On the other side of our posturing and our striving, a table of grace is waiting to be shared. A table where we can love freely and we are freely loved. I'd like to invite the ushers to come forward and take the offering.